Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome everyone to this really rather wonderful event on power and storytelling. It comes towards the end of the week of the LSE Festival events on the theme of power and politics. And it's marvellous to see so many people here, and quite a lot of people also online. Welcome, everybody. I'm Sarah Worthington. I'm a professor of law at the LSE, and I'm chairing this event. And in that role, it's my pleasure to introduce Naila Kabir. Professor Kabir will guide and moderate this afternoon's conversation. She's going to introduce the two authors that we have with us this afternoon, and then all three will engage in a conversation about Naila's book and about various other things that they have thought about. We've got an hour, and the conversation here and my introduction will take about 45 minutes, and then we'll take 15 minutes for Q&A. You might wonder why I, as a lawyer, have been given this very important role of introducing Naila Kabir. And the answer is quite simple. We do have a connection. I'm the new chair of LSE Press. It's a new academic press, or relatively new academic press, and it publishes works of serious and original scholarship in the social sciences. Now, Naila Kabir has had over a dozen books published with various presses, and she's chosen to have her last book published with, her most recent book published with us. It comes out in the summer, so this is the anticipation, and it will be free to read online. So all the LSE Press books are open access, all free to read online. I'm not going to tell you anything about the book, because I'm sure that will emerge in the conversation with Monica Alley and Philip Henshaw. But I must tell you something about Naila. She's been a professor at the LSE for the past 10 years, and then much earlier than that, she did her undergraduate degree and her PhD here. But in between, she's done some widely known and very influential work on gender and development, and that's taken her to a variety of universities in the UK and overseas, and she's advised lots of UK and overseas public institutions. She's currently the faculty's associate at the LSE's International Inequalities Institute, and she's on the governing board of the Atlantic Fellowship for Social and Economic Equity. She's also predictably an elected fellow of the Academy for Social Sciences. She has a very long entry on Wikipedia and quite a long entry on the LSE website where you can get the detail, but I won't detain you any longer with the introduction. So without more ado, I'll hand over to Naila. Please can you give her a big welcome.
I think you can tell that there are a lot of family and friends here. Okay. Let me begin by extending my gratitude to LSE Press for the very painless process through which they transformed a fairly unwieldy manuscript into what will be an open access book that you can freely download anywhere in the world. Most academic authors don't make a lot of money out of their books, but they do value reaching a wide readership, and the LSE Press has made this possible in principle. The rest, of course, depends on the quality of the book and who it is able to speak to. But the entire team have been wonderful, as has been the previous and current chairs of the press, Professor Patrick Dunleavy and Professor Sarah Worthington. Thank you also to the organizers of LSE Festival for giving us a space on a very packed and exciting program and helping us to publicize the event. And finally, of course, thank you to my two co-panelists for taking time out from their Saturdays to be here. Both are extremely successful writers of fiction. Both have written several novels and short stories, and both have been given public recognition for their work, as you will have seen from the publicity for this event. And I think I should just mention that Monica Ali has just been awarded the CBC.
CB.
Yes. which, for those who don't know, is a very big deal. There's another reason for my invitation to both of them. They are both connected in some way to Bangladesh, which is what my book is about. Monica was born there and then migrated to the UK at the age of 3 with her parents. While Philip was born in the UK, he has married into Bangladesh and so presumably has Bangladeshi in-laws. And that gives him a very particular perspective, I think, on the country and its culture. I myself was born in India. I migrated to what became Bangladesh with my parents at the tender age of 1. So it wasn't a voluntary migration. I later migrated voluntarily to the UK as an adult. So Philip's novel, Scenes from Early Life, is set in Bangladesh and covers some of the material that is there in my book. He has also written The Friendly Ones, which deals with the South Asian immigrant experience in the UK. Monica Ali's book, Brick Lane, is partly set in Bangladesh and partly the UK, and also touches on some of the material that there is in my book. Her most recent book, Love Marriage, deals with the experience of South Asian immigrants in the UK. They are both erudite and, above all, witty writers. And if you haven't read them, now is the time to begin. And some of their books are available, and if you're very lucky, they might sign them. So while this event is very loosely organized around my forthcoming book, it is also a space for us to reflect on the process of writing by some of the practitioners. In particular, I want it to be about what distinguishes those of us who use stories about and by people to inform writing within the social sciences and those who use these stories to write fiction. My own work is rooted in feminist economics and development studies. Both are branches of the social sciences which accommodate considerable interdisciplinarity, but I want to come back to the word discipline later. What I would like to do in this brief introduction is set the stage, talk a bit about what my book is about, my reflections when I was writing it, and then I want to put some questions to Philip and Monica that relate only partly to my book, but it's also much more about their own reflections about what and how they write, and given that power is a theme of this festival, to ask how power enters into their lives as writers. Let me start with a conversation I had with a friend of mine, a colleague, many years ago, called Anne-Marie Goetz. We were passing time, I think over breakfast. It was probably the Makerere University guest house. And we were discussing how we regarded our role as writers. Anne-Marie said she thought of her writing as a form of art. Hoity-toity, I thought. My own supervisor had told me to regard my writing as a craft. So not a nod to aesthetics, but a focus on utility and practicality. Continuing the conversation, Anne-Marie said that when she came to the process of writing, she saw herself as a chef who gathered different kinds of ingredients and now had to work out how to turn them into a delicious dish. So the artistic theme remained. I veered off, however, abandoning my craft metaphor, and said that I saw myself as a detective, confronted with a mystery to solve, what we call a research question. My role was to gather clues and then assemble them to provide a solution to the mystery. So I was determinedly prosaic. But Anne-Marie's words came back to me several times while I was writing this book, and I reminded her of them when I saw her in New York earlier this year. She, of course, had forgotten this conversation, but it remained in my mind. So this book that I've written is about a mystery, or what has been called a paradox. It's about a country that was portrayed as a hopeless basket case at the time of its independence in 1971. It was abjectly poor, among the poorest in the world. It had extremely high fertility rates, amongst the highest in the world. The literature about Bangladesh at the time is full of statements like, this is a country that is the size of Wisconsin, or Netherlands, or fill in the gap, and it has a population that is 10, 20, 30 times those countries, to get you to get into your brain how overpopulated this country was. It also had a very extreme form of patriarchy and a strong culture of son preference. Unlike the rest of the world, females died in larger numbers than men, males in almost every age group, starting from birth. Yet, within a decade or so, we started to see signs of progress. Even before per capita growth rates went up, even before poverty started to decline, we started to see the fact that fertility began to decline, life expectancy went up, children started to go to school, and most surprisingly, this progress benefited women disproportionately, so that patriarchal inequalities began to diminish. A striking marker of this change was the fact that daughters were now more likely to survive the early years of life than sons. A change from the past, a change from India, but in line with the rest of the world. There are many caveats one could make to this positive story, but that the most oppressive aspects of patriarchy were diminishing cannot be denied. So that is the mystery I set out to solve. How did Bangladesh make this journey from being what was described as a test case for development? If you could manage development in Bangladesh, you could manage it anywhere. How did it go from there to become one of the miracle stories of the Millennium Development Goals? And what role did women have to play in this, shifting patriarchal norms, and how did they do it? So harking back to my detective role, this was less a whodunit and more of how was it done. I already had some clues which had been suggested by others. They all pointed to what I call the big picture story, the role of the state, the role of donors, the role of the private sector, of NGOs. But the kind of change I was interested in could not have happened without ordinary people changing their behavior, without them looking at their prospects differently, questioning what had been taken as given in their lives, aspiring to a different future for themselves, for their children, and especially for their daughters. So a great deal of the book focuses on the stories of different generations of men, women, and sometimes children, the stories they told about their lives, about their small dreams and their big dreams and how these evolved. It was in the process of gathering these clues that the stories yielded that my conversation with Anne-Marie often came back. I still retained the metaphor of the detective who looked for clues, but once the process of assembling these clues to provide a persuasive solution to the mystery, to a satisfactory resolution to the paradox had been completed, and by the time I started to write this book, I started to think of myself more as a lawyer who was confronted by a large and unknown jury made up of a cross-section of people, some of whom knew nothing about Bangladesh and cared even less, some of whom were aware of what I was trying to do and were sympathetic, and some of whom were very, it's plausible. I wanted to draw them all in. But writing a book as a social scientist who had temporarily stepped into the role of a lawyer meant that I had to retain my focus on evidence, that I had to be able to weave together a story of the systematic relationship between everyday first-hand explanations for changing aspirations and behavior and for second-order explanations that social scientists derive from a combination of theory and the larger picture, which may not always be apparent to people on the ground. In other words, while valuing what people said and did about themselves and those around them, I still had to locate their accounts within a larger context and work out what shaped their subjective interpretations and how accurate these might be. Social sciences are about evidence, about reliable and verifiable evidence, and I think David Lewis over there might have something more to say about verifiability as a possible distinction between social sciences and fiction. So the evidence that is in my book that makes up my story brings together life histories, focus group discussions, the ideas and views of relevant actors, but it also goes into the history of the country, to its current political economy, and where it made sense to do so, to statistical findings that increased confidence in qualitative insights and distinguished between typical and atypical findings. Let me summarize what someone said about the kind of process that I'm describing. And this is going back to being a lawyer. In a court trial, subjective perceptions of facts and reasons are submitted to various inferential and documentary tests. The judge and jury do not simply impute reasons and motives to defendants, however plausible they may sound. Documentary evidence and testimony must be produced to support an explanation which has been formulated in terms of reasons for behavior rather than causes in the strict sense of the term. Verdict is reached by bringing together the external evidence and how a person describes his or her intentions. I hope that kind of reflects what your practice is, Sarah. But there is something else missing in this account, and that may be as relevant in a court of law as it is in the social sciences, and that is emotion. Both prosecution and defense do not simply state the bare facts. They also attempt to sway the jury by appeals to their emotion. And that is where I think the art that Anne-Marie was talking about comes into social science writing. What I wanted to do in this book was to go beyond the facts and explanations and to convey, often using first-hand testimonies, how people saw the world, what moved them, and what moved me. It is particularly important to me because so many of us in Bangladesh have grown up with images of a country and its people that deprive them of humanity, of agency, of ordinary everyday emotions. I remember when I published a book when I was at the Institute of Development Studies about what women were saying about microfinance, an English colleague of mine said to me, "Do Bangladeshi women really talk like that?" And I said, "Yes, they do, but in Bengali." So this book, as all my previous work, pays a great deal of attention to what people say. But this poses a problem that takes me back to the distinction I feel between social sciences and fiction. No matter how interdisciplinary your branch of the social sciences is, the discipline does not disappear. You may have an eye on a wider audience, but your position as an academic requires verifiability. The need to sift through facts and figures, through contradictory and competing accounts, in order to craft the story that you want to tell. And one of the most frustrating things about writing about women in Bangladesh is almost every single important intervention that has happened to them has been beset with competing interpretations. The widespread introduction of community-based family planning has been seen as a war on women's bodies, the manifestation of the neo-Malthusian fears, or it has been seen as extending reproductive choice to very poor women. Microfinance has been seen as efforts to turn them into greedy neoliberal subjects, or as extending a resource that they had been historically denied. Jobs in the garment sector have been seen as international capital exploiting cheap labor, or as expanding job opportunities in a highly gender-segregated labor market. And most recently, with more women veiling themselves, we can interpret this as growing adherence, to a growing Islamic orthodoxy, or a pragmatic way of gaining public mobility. Two of my colleagues, Cecile Jackson and Nithya Rao, once pointed to what they described as the habitus, the predisposition of those of us who do research in gender and development, which is to read all social change as negative. It's bad now, and it's only going to get worse. So nothing ever seems to improve. This, they suggest, is grounded in the need to focus on the legion of problems that women across the world continue to face despite real improvements. My book suffers from a bias in the opposite direction. Because it seeks to explain improvements in the lives of women and girls, it may give too short a shrift to the very real problems that they continue to face. It is not always easy to find the right balance. But if I have erred towards the positive, it is because stories of Bangladesh in its early post-independence period were so relentlessly negative that some bias in the opposite direction seems necessary. So, now, turning to my fellow panelists, I think what I'm trying to convey, is no matter how moving and how powerful is the story that I want to tell, writing as a social scientist means that I am never free to tell that story as I see it or as I hear it. There have to be footnotes. There have to be references. You have to cite the previous literature, identify the gaps in the literature. I can see a lot of empathy over there. And then you have to take on the arguments and interpretations of people before you, no matter how wrong you think they might be, and you have to do it with respect. All this is very frustrating. I could never write fiction because of a lifetime of training in the disciplinary world of social scientists. I see the need, I recognize the need for discipline, but sometimes I wish it was not so constraining. Sometimes I wish I could break free. So my question, from the, perhaps idealizing the world of fiction writers, I would like to turn to both Philip and Monica and ask if any part of the frustrations I describe is familiar to them, but also what they believe to be the constraints that they face when they sit down to write their fiction. What is it that they have to grapple with? So shall I start with Monica? Let's start with Philip.
Start with the easy questions. to ask the hard question is easy, as Auden said. I think that the challenge really is thinking what, you know, one doesn't want as a novelist to be constrained by factual research and to find out, not to write anything that isn't true, because, you know, we want our imagination. But I think it's very important to for someone like me to ask the question, if I don't do enough asking and talking and questioning, what am I going to fall back on? And there are so many kind of rather kind of flat notions of people unlike one that before you know it, you're kind of falling into cliché and doesn't really kind of convey anything about the individual life. And so I think you sort of, as a novelist, you sort of learn to look out, not for the thing that you expect to see, but the thing that truly surprises you. And that may be a very kind of untypical thing. I mean, for me, writing a novel, it's like there's been a pile of material kind of being slowly amassed over years, probably, and it's just sitting there. If you think of a big pile of wood or chips or chips of wood or bits of paper, and then somebody tells you something, and it's as if they've got out a match and struck it, and then suddenly, there it is. Now, the example that I could choose, and it's a very kind of untypical way into the big historical phenomenon of the Bangladesh War of Independence, which is two of my books are largely about. The first one, it's basically a kind of a ghost-written life of my husband, and he for years would kind of tell. He's a very good storyteller. And for years he would tell me a story and I'd kind of laugh and then he would say, I'm going to write my autobiography one day, it can't be hard, I've seen you writing a book, it's not hard. So I was and it went on like this, and I had a lot of kind of very kind of good stories about his family and his aunts and his childhood. And one of the things that he had told me about was we had this weird kind of shared cultural thing, which was that he'd watched many of the same children's television programmes as I had. Double Deckers was a big thing in the 1970s. It was also shown on Bangladesh television. And the other thing that was big was the 1977, I think, series Roots, Alex Haley's book. And he was telling me about how this was such a big deal in the children of Dan Mondi that they would go out into the streets and they would reenact Roots. And he was always the slave owner because he was the fairest one of all of us. So anyway, so then he said, but of course we couldn't play with the boy next door. And I said, what do you mean we couldn't play with the boy next door? And he said, oh, well, no, they were collaborators. And at that point, I said, what do you mean they're collaborators? His parents were collaborators, so we couldn't. And I was like, that's the match, you know. And after that, I thought, this is not just a mass of paper, it's a story I want to tell. So what I'm saying is that it's something very kind of untypical, not a kind of survey. Sometimes it's the last thing you expect to hear, and that sets it off.
One thing I just really picked up from what you said, and I can imagine from having read some of your work, is your fear of the cliché.
It's dreadful.
Yes, yes. And sometimes you're not very kind to people who use clichés. Yeah. But
how can you?
I know.
How can you look at something so interesting and you say, yes. Oh, you know, I mean, I was this morning, when people say, I mean, some clichés are brilliant, of course, you know, some clichés are great fun. Yes. Sometimes you see something so interesting, and I remember once years ago seeing on a television program somebody who had by mistake put their pet dog in the washing machine, and it kind of came out after 30 seconds, so quite all right, but looking very confused. And they interviewed her on the television and said, and I thought, well, that's quite an extraordinary thing to do. And they interviewed her and said, well, what was it like? And she said, well, my husband said that he looked like a drowned rat. And I was like, oh, oh, think harder, convey. Oh.
No, I sympathise. I do sympathise with your angst about this. And it is, it's laziness, isn't it? It's sort of, sometimes it's lack of imagination and sometimes it's laziness. You just slip into the easiest way of describing
it. Mostly it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But I think when we've got a, I mean, I think that if you're a novelist, and particularly if you're, you know, say a... An English novelist trying to write about the lives of people who are very unlike you, I think it really matters that you don't slip into cliché. You know, you don't start saying that people have almond, I don't know, you know those clichés, you know, abuse.
And I think to some extent a lot of what I write is about, not so much about cliché, but about stereotypes, which is a form of cliché, about how easily people fall into who they do this and they don't do that. I remember when I first came to Britain and I was 18 or 19, my first time, and I would often hear on the buses, they don't say thank you, do they? And actually, in Bangladesh, we do have a word for thank you, but we often smile it, right? We indicate it with our bodies and our faces, but we don't. To say thank you to someone is sort of unnecessarily formal. It has to be very formal.
It's a very culturally specific thing yes. saying thank you.
Yes.
And if in French you say thank you so much, it feels quite offensive to French people.
Yes.
It feels as if you've actually said, thank you very much, in a rather sarcastic way. Because actually the politeness is conveyed in the
yes.
fact that you said monsieur or madame
yes.
to them. But to say...
And there used to be an advertisement about, I think it was Gilby's Gin, as English as Gilby's Gin, when you had this person going through a cinema dance, just going, sorry, 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 sorry. So, you know, we don't say sorry, do we? And I just want to pick up one other point and then turn to Monica. And I thought this business of the match was fascinating. And I read about that boy and I read how isolated, I guess, he was in that community, close-knit community, as a collaborator. And that word collaborator remained for a long time. And it was like the worst thing you could accuse someone of in Bangladesh for having collaborated with the Pakistan Army.
It still seems pretty bad to me.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Yes, it does. But it's used by fewer and fewer people because a new generation have grown up who don't necessarily share that vocabulary. But I thought it was interesting that was the point that made the rest of the story
yes.
come together as something that you could...
It's just something so strange that a novel says to you,
yeah.
and you have to do it. And I think the strangest one that ever happened to me, I wrote a novel about the First Afghan War, about set in the 1840s, the whole thing set in the 1840s, full-dress historical novel. And I wrote it in the late 90s, and I had no idea why I was writing this novel. I just had to write it. It was just... And there came this point about halfway through, and the British had just taken Kabul, and my hero rode out into the desert, and he heard a noise in the sky, and he looked up in the year 1842, and there was a jet plane going across the sky from east to west. And I wrote it, and I thought, What is this doing in my book? And my editor, why have you put a jet plane in? It's kind of completely unexplained in the book. And I said, Nicholas, I cannot tell you. It has to be there. It just has to be there. And I wrote it, and it was delivered at the beginning of 2001. And the proof was delivered into my hands on the 10th of September 2001. And the next day I looked at the television screen and I saw the jets going from east to west, and I thought, that was the novel speaking to me. And you learn to understand those commands that a novel makes to you. Just, you know, and when a novel wants you to do something really strange, whether with an individual or a big gesture, you obey it because the meaning. You know, I sound mad, I know. I sound mad.
So. I'm glad you saw those jets afterwards.
Yeah, well,
justified.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Monica, what are your constraints when you sit down? And
yeah, well, I think the grass is always greener, Nyla. So, you know, I dream about having constraints and how liberating those constraints might be for my writing. I mean, I love the research process because to me it feels easier than facing that dreadful moment of it's just me and the blank page and you've got to make stuff up. I always think that with the research, I mean, I do enough of it that it gives me the confidence to make stuff up, but I always put the research away because I don't at that point actually want to be constrained. But I want to say something more general about the constraints for, you know, serious writers of fiction or writers of serious fiction at the moment, and they're largely financial. So, I mean, I don't know if anybody knows what the average earnings, the median earnings of a full-time author is in the UK, but the latest figures that I saw, end of 2022, it was research commissioned by the ALCS, which is the Authors Licensing and Collecting Society. The median income is £7,000 a year. And I've got a few facts and figures. Don't worry, I've got a lot, but I'm not going to read them all out. But that's dropped 43% since 2007, when the median income was £12,330. So that obviously makes writing unsustainable and inaccessible for the vast majority of people. I mean, you've got to have private wealth or you've got to have a partner who's willing to fund you. It's also, as Nicola Solomon, who's the chief exec of the Society of Authors, she made a comment when that report was published that was a year that publishers posted record profits. And the median earnings from self-employed writing doesn't even come close to a living wage. So there's another aspect to that, which is that there's a gender pay gap.
Why am I not surprised?
Oh, wait for it. 41.4%, and with women experiencing a 21% drop in income in real terms between 2017 and 2020 against 10% for men. The other disparity, can we guess? Black and mixed race authors receive disproportionately less than white authors and experience steeper losses year to year. The median earnings of Asian authors were higher than black and mixed race authors, but lower than white authors. So there's something very wrong with this picture. We're not talking about 20, 30 years ago. We're talking about now. So whatever the, you know, the constraints that one feels when one sits down to write, I just feel very lucky that I have a room in which to write and that I can put my whole mind to it, because I'm not now, I mean, I was when I started, and I did it anyway, but I'm not now constrained in that way. But it's a terrible indictment of, you know, the lack of funding for the arts. We don't support our writers properly. The Irish do it much better. The results are telling. I mean, I grew up in a house with no books. Books were much more expensive then. I grew up in a poor household. I had a library card, and that was my route in, that was my access. Libraries have been cut back a great deal as well. There's been a lot of noise since Black Lives Matter about diversity in publishing. You know, the proof is in the pudding, the figures don't lie. So, you know, I think there's work to be done.
Two things. Let me pick up the first one, and that was when you were talking about doing the research. So I know in your current book, I know you're not a medical person, and you don't practice in a hospital, etc.
I was interviewed by Rachel Clark, you know, who, she's an end-of-life care specialist doctor. I was interviewed by her at a literary festival. I think it was in Bath, actually. And she said, oh, yeah, when I read, you know, all these medical contexts and characters, I thought, she was obviously a doctor in a previous life. And I thought, yes, thank you. That was such a compliment.
Yes, it worked. But I find, so I rather like that as a non-fiction writer. You know, this doing the research, which we all do, you know, fiction, non-fiction, etc., listening to stories, etc. But then at that point, our paths diverge. And you take that research and you kind of distance yourself from it so that you can then engage in an act of imagination where that research may be woven in and out, but it's not what it's about. So I thought that was a very... it's quite an interesting difference between the way we go about things. Going back to the point that you're making, you know, it's not just arts and culture that is being deprived of any kind of public support. It's education.
Yeah.
And we're seeing all the kind of the humanities and the softer subjects being deprived of funding, of public funding. And these are not people who are necessarily going to go out into the labour market and make a lot of money, but they're going to make a lot of people happy. But that's not... That doesn't have a monetary value, you know. So I think what you're describing, its roots are in the attitudes of one government after another towards the things that don't, as I think of, add to the gross domestic product, you know, and I think arts, culture, etc., is about that. But is there something else going on with the publishing industry? Is there something about the way they push or publicise certain kinds of books over others? Is there...
I think it's more general than that. I'm not saying that that's not the case, but I think it's reflective of the winner-takes-all culture that we see, an environment and economy that we seem to have entered. Yeah. I mean, you know, inequality is ever-increasing. Nobody seems to bat an eyelid. Mm-hmm. And that's reflected in the structure of how book publishing works. I mean, there's a small number of books that do exceedingly well, and the publishers, you know, I don't think they're evil, or it's a sort of throw it at the wall and see what stinks, you know, publishing culture, and then they're very good at jumping on the books that appear to be taking off, plus the few surefire bets. I mean, you know, if J.K. Rowling publishes another book, of course they're going to put money into the marketing because, you know, they'd be foolish not to. So I think it's those things that come to the fore for me.
And I wonder what impact that has if you're not going to be able to make a living, if your books don't sell. What impact does it have on the kind of book you end up wanting to write? In other words, does it veer you in the direction of cliches and easy winners?
Maybe it veers you in the direction of romanticy, which is the biggest selling genre at the moment, which is a mashup of romance and fantasy. I'd never heard of that until a few months ago, and I was told that's the largest selling category of fiction at the moment. I don't know. People want to write. People will follow their hearts and do the work, but it is also then limiting who is allowed into that arena. I mean, it's all very well to say, you know, we want to hear from more diverse backgrounds, but unless you've got the funding in place to do that, people have to put food on the table, right? So that is automatically narrowing the gene pool and the talent pool. Yeah. And to me, that is a real problem. And there's the little initiatives here and there. Of course there are people, you know, I'm sure if you had a publisher here on the stage, they would say we've got this initiative and that initiative. But overall, the picture is not great.
And those initiatives need to go on over periods. I think that publishers are very prone to fastening on, you know, Scandinavian crime writers or black African novelists, or in the 1980s there was a phase of Czech magical realists, and it goes on for a bit, and then kind of 10 years later, we're on to the next thing, you know. And there's a kind, and we're not giving people a chance, not just to publish one or two books, but to have a long-lasting career.
That's exactly right. It's that, you know, sink or swim attitude instead of investing over the career, or over the length of time of an author's career. And I think those used to happen a lot more. There would be more cross-subsidy within the imprint, within the publishing house, so that the big money makers would, they would subsidise, you know, well, the mid-list authors.
Cats kept Faber going for decades, and they used it very sensibly. They used it to encourage new talent. The money was pouring in, so let's have a plunge on, you know, this Italian novelist called Aldo Busi. Very interesting, you know, never going to sell more than 500 copies, but who cares?
And now each title is supposed to make it have its own bottom line and work in its own financial times. And I think, you know, the thing about books is that books matter. They change people's minds. They deal in complexity and nuance. They put you, they put the reader in another pair of shoes. They see, you see the world through another pair of eyes. And in the culture right now, we're seeing more and more division, oversimplification, you know, polar opposites. Novels are the counterweight to that. You know, they matter.
I think that's
the publishing world become as concentrated as, let us say, the retail world? And I mean, is it now dominated by the huge publishers? Or are there?
Yeah, there are independent presses, and they, you know, the LSE is a, would you call yourself an independent press?
Very independent.
I mean, of course, you know, and some of them do produce prize winners and surprises and so on, but there's no doubt about it that the big four publishers dominate.
For me, I kind of see what you're talking about. But,
so I know you're about to launch into the next question, and the audience doesn't look like they are full of questions. They look like they're intent on listening. But we're going to be thrown out in a bit under 15 minutes. So could we interleave questions from...
Less than 15.
Ooh. Questions from the audience with questions. So if you don't have any, fine. But I don't want to let you go without having the opportunity, and then we can just keep on pattering. So there are roving microphones. I'll take the gentleman up there with the black jumper on, and then at the front here in the middle.
Hi, my name is Bulbul Hassan. I'm a British Bangladeshi journalist and part-time fiction writer. I've got a question for Monica Ali. I've read your novel, Brick Lane. In relation to that, I'm curious to know, you have portrayed the life of a woman who was trying to struggle to integrate with the society, British society, and there have been numerous struggles of the immigrants. So my question is, did you want to tell the story driven by the motivation you have or any sort of moral obligation, or you just wanted to tell the story to your experience as an immigrant?
What was my motivation for telling... my protagonist is called Nazni. What was my motivation for telling her story? I mean, it was... That would take me several days to give you my full motivation, but Nyla's book, The Power to Choose, about garment workers in the East End of London and in Dhaka, was one of my big motivations. I read that book and that, you know, I drew a lot on that, and I did a lot of research in the East End. I went and interviewed youth workers, social workers, talked to people in women's centres, just walked around the estates, people who were drugs workers who were helping youths who had drug addiction problems, all sorts of things. So there was a big sort of, this is a research process, right? There's a lot. And then some of the sparks, I mean, some of the sparks are not obvious at all. My mum, who is white English, she made an opposite journey to Nazni. She went to Dhaka to marry my dad. She didn't know the language, the culture, didn't know anyone there. And she used to talk to me about that experience and how she had that total social and cultural dislocation. And that was one of my starting points for Nazneen. So it's a really good question, but it's really hard to answer in a succinct way.
Actually, I know that I wanted David to raise a question that he and I have discussed, which is of interest, I think, to all of us. David, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah. I'm David Lewis at the LSE. I'm in Nyla's department. So
I've got two questions, really. I mean, one is this issue that we're coming back to again and again about, you know, both academic work and novels are both engaged in the business of telling a story, constructing a narrative. But what makes the narrative convincing when we're writing fiction? What makes the narrative convincing when we're doing an academic study? And I'm interested to ask the panel, really, what are the things that you might have considered putting into your narrative but left out because you felt, well, it's either implausible, because it seems to me that plausibility is one of the keys to writing fiction, whereas verifiability is one of the keys to good academic work. But it seems to me those things are not exclusive in either form. So that was one thing I'd love to get people's views on. The other question is really that it seems to me that, you know, we've heard a little bit about the, you know, the horrors of contemporary society, growing inequality and everything. You know, that we need both of these ways of storytelling if we're going to deal with complexity. And I wonder if you agree with me that we should be thinking more and more in terms of using multiple texts in the way that we teach, in the way that we learn, in the way that we educate. And I'm really heartened by these, you know, the rise of these kinds of fields that are very interdisciplinary and synthetic, like environmental humanities, where people say, if we're going to understand environment and environmental crisis, we're going to need to understand climate science, we're going to need to understand, you know, social science, and we're going to need to understand poetry. And that if we, you know, we should be teaching all of these things, and they, you know, they each broaden our understanding of a topic and our insight.
Plausibility, verifiability.
Well, I don't think plausibility is a standard judgment for the novel. I think that incredulity is quite a good response by a reader. I think the fundamental difference for me between academic social studies and the novel is that the novel can be concerned with the kind of fascinating life of somebody who's totally atypical, not like anybody else in the world. No one else has ever lived like this. But social science, I don't think they would find that quite as interesting as large-scale human phenomena. The other, for the second part of the question about should novels be used as part of academic kind of teaching practice? I myself don't see the kind of the life of the novel within institutions. I don't see it being sustained as by kind of professorial practice. I see the kind of I see the life of the novel going on, being readers dashing into John Sando with their 20 quid, you know, saying, please give me the new Monica Ali. And that's wonderful. You know, I don't think that it's to do with the approval or the judgment of institutional practice. I think they can, you know, I think it has a certain value, but it's also true that you wouldn't really want to learn about humanity from a very good novel. I mean, you know, I would hate to think of anybody kind of seriously studying the Napoleonic Wars by reading even War and Peace. You know, you just you know, it just doesn't make sense, really.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of disagreed slightly with Philip about the plausibility aspect. I mean, what's that old quote from G.K. Chesterton about the difference between fact and fiction is that fiction has to be credible, because facts are just often not at all credible. And I do find myself, you know, sometimes hurling a novel aside because I think, I just don't believe a word of this. And you've got to, you know, it's got to me at least as a reader, to feel that there's something true about it, even though that I know that it's being made up. Totally agree about the extraordinary characters. I mean, you teach writing a lot more than I do, but, you know, I've taught it from time to time, creative writing, and students all too often want to have a character, a protagonist, who's a sort of ordinary Joe. you know, and I had some, yeah, there's nothing unordinary or special about this person. Perhaps you should think of somebody else because, you know, real life is a grind, it's dull, it's boring. And we just tend to be attracted to protagonists who are, in a way, larger than life. Don't think it sort of gets you off the plausibility hook, to my mind, anyway.
I will dissent slightly in this interview, just tiny bit.
No,
because I do think that very ordinary
people... You can't stop a writer.
Very ordinary people examined in the microscope until their lives are so extraordinary. I think they're some of my favourite novels. There's a wonderful novel by Jivanananda Das that was... Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just about this married couple, very quiet married couple, living their ordinary lives, and he just goes through their lives, and oh, my God, by the end, it's wonderful. Okay.
I think
This is what it's like.
No, really, we have one question here still, and I've got a cue from online. Okay. So what I'm going to do is take all three, if I can, because time is up, and you're to answer all the way along the row. So I'll do this. Answer all along the row in one sentence. You can pick any question you like, answer in one sentence, because then we're going to be thrown out. I'm really sorry about this. But isn't this the way you like events to go? Everybody wants more.
We're subversive.
I'm going to do the two from online first and then take the gentleman here in the middle. But the two from online, the first one is from Ofer Ben David Erez, who's from Haifa, and he says, of the authors writing today, who would you recommend to him that is using writing in order to effectively impact culture and social change? And then the second one is from an Irish writer living in the north of England, doesn't give his or her name. Mairead O'Hanlon, so she does give her name. You mentioned the lack of support for writers in the UK, and Monica Alley mentioned the better support available to Irish residents, which is very true. Given the upcoming election, what should we agitate for? And what form of support is needed? And then the third question here.
Thank you very much. Monica, it's very interesting you said about financial restriction and how that could perhaps impact the power of authors to make their point. And I was just casting my mind back to the end of the Net Book Agreement, the fixed cost, I think that's what it was called. And I wondered if when that stopped, that impacted the ability of publishers to support in the way that you were explaining, Ms. Tencher, about the supporting perhaps less popular works, for want of a better phrase. I was wondering what the panel's view on that was.
One sentence, not the Peter Carey sentence that goes from the first in the novel right to the very end without a full stop.
I don't understand enough about the Net Book Agreement and the impact to answer on that. So the two writers who I'd recommend who I think are making a big impact in terms of understanding of world events. One is Isabella Hamad. I would recommend everybody go and read Enter Ghost, which is about Palestine. And the second one has just won the Women's Prize for Fiction, is Brotherless Night by V.V. Ganeshanathan. It's about the Sri Lankan Civil War, and they're both utterly brilliant.
I totally agree about the Net Book Agreement. I think it was the worst thing that Tony Blair ever did, apart from a couple of other things. I think that the other thing that is worth bearing in mind is that the price of hardback books is absolutely frozen for the last 25 years. My second novel came out in 1996. Hardback was $17.99. My last book came out in hardback. It was also $17.99. Now, why can't publishers charge what books are worth, you know? And why this slashing of budget? When the last Harry Potter came out, hardly anybody bought it at anything but below cost price. They could have charged 50 quid a copy for that last Harry Potter. Why not? It would have kept them going for decades. Anyway, I'm not going to recommend a writer. I'm going to recommend a new book. And I would really like everybody to rush out and buy this because it will open up what you know about a literature. And it's Aaron Arva's Sinha's new Penguin book of the Bengali short story. Aaron Arva Sinha is, in my view, the greatest translator now at work. he put together this incredible collection. And I knew five or six authors in the book. You might not know any more than Tagore and maybe Satyajit Ray. It is full of masterpieces, and it is unbelievable. Buy it. Go out and buy it.
Naila, one sentence.
Oh, as it happens, I'm not going to name the book that changed lives, etc. But as it happens, I was given that book in my leaving due day before yesterday. So I will be reading it very fast. But I think if I look back on the books that I've read and so on, I think Amitav Ghosh's book, The Hungry Tide, is one that remains with me, and Barbara Kingsolver's book. And these were both books, interestingly, about the environment. So I think the novels that are speaking to me now are novels that are alerting me to what's going on in the world.
Yeah, it's very true. Okay. The chair gets into trouble if she doesn't get you out in time. So I have a number of things to do at the end. The first one, of course, is to say thank you, the audience, both here in the room and online. You've been fabulous. I mean, if you could have seen the picture of all your faces, you were just absolutely intent on the speakers, and it's wonderful to have such a receptive audience. This is part of the LSE Festival, which ends at 7:30 today. So if you've still got time, you could pick up another couple of events, I suppose. Probably not as good as this one, another couple. There's a book purchase and book signing outside, if you're interested. And Naila's book, which isn't out yet, there are flyers there and details of how you can get hold of it when it comes out later in summer. And then, of course, my final thanks to Naila and to Monica and to Philip. Could we thank them all? I won't miss them.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.